what's an artist to do in a world where we seem to be losing our civic common ground? Should they be cybernauts showing us how to configure the internet to a higher purpose? Aestheticians finding and spreading beauty and joy? Activists? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, some explorer artists. Yes, art is a way of exploring. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. Art with engagement is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I'm really happy to be returning to the subject of the day, the value of art in modern Alaska. I have long believed that Alaska's circumstances give it an opportunity to lead the world in the field of cross-cultural communication, not only between indigenous and arriving cultures, but between the cultures of academia, the professions, and the arts. And so every time I can get some artists on here and get them talking and take it to some territory where it's not thought that artists are likely to be, I consider it a bit of a victory, and that's what we're doing today. We've got some pretty exciting guests. I'm going to start with the Beehive Design Collective and Brandon B. and get him to explain why he's in Alaska right now. He joins us by cell phone from the Kenai Peninsula, where he's just been attending salmon stock. Brandon, welcome to Talk of Alaska, and give me some idea of what it is that you people are exhibiting. Oh, all that buildup. All that buildup, and all of a sudden we lose the connection. Great. Okay. Well, we're trying to surmount some technical difficulties that are getting in the way of our telephone connection with our guests. So I'm going to try our other guest and see what happens. Karen Frantzine, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. I'm still here.
Good. Glad to hear from you. Karen is the curator of the Art of Fire exhibition in Time of Change program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bonanza Creek Experimental Forest, and she joins us by phone from Fairbanks. And Karen, the show just went up. It's up right now, right? How does it look?
It looks fantastic. Of course, I'm a little biased, but from everything I've heard from the people who came to the opening up night on Friday, we had a bumper crowd for what was supposed to be a two-hour opening, stretched almost a three-hour opening, with a lot of good compliments. Very interesting exhibit.
It is, I think, from the point of view of the artist, it's easy to understand how this process would lead to some interesting work. From the point of view of the science, maybe it's a little bit more difficult to grasp what this project is about. But as I understand it, this has actually been going on for a while, where Bonanza Creek has been inviting artists in to take field trips with the scientists and then come up with art of some sort out of their experience, right?
Yeah, and actually, I only got involved a few years ago, but my understanding is this actually started about 5 or 6 years ago with a program they called In a Time of Change at the time. And they invited a handful of artists who at that time were mostly writers, performers, musicians, dancers, and a few visual artists as well, to go out to their long-term ecological research stations and spend a day just learning about how long-term research is conducted and what some of their findings were. And as a result of that, they came back with no intention originally, I guess, to put on a show, but the artists were so inspired that they put something together and had a one-night stage performance. And there was so much interest in it, both from the scientific community who went and watched it, and then also from artists who had the honor of participating, and generally the community that
Yeah.
I'm sorry, there was a dial tone. I thought I'd lost you. From the community artists here in town as well, everybody wanted to participate, and so it has continued to keep going. We're in about our fifth generation now of programs.
Yeah, and you're already thinking about next year's, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the first few times it was the field trip was during the summer, and then within a few months there was either the exhibit or the presentations, and that was just too short of a time frame to artists to be able to create. So a couple years ago we switched to a two-year time frame where the artists go out in the field trips in one summer, and then by the following year there's an exhibit and or stage performance.
Oh, I see. So, in other words, the process is pretty well along already.
Yeah. So this Art of Fire exhibit that just went up is the culmination of about 2 years of planning and execution of the field trips, selection of the artists, but it's not going to stop here. This is the premier opening, and it'll be going to Anchorage at Alaska Pacific University in January of 2013, and then we're working on some other venues as well beyond that.
Well, great. And have you, as an artist, have you participated in this?
Yeah, I wear two hats. I'm curating this one only, but I was involved in the previous one in a minor way. The previous one was the one-year condensed version where we went on the field trips in June and then had...
Did we just pop a connection again? Yeehaw, okay. Oh, yeah. I love live radio. It's all happening in real time, folks. So we've lost both of our connections. We're trying to bridge together a situation where some of the equipment doesn't work that connects the telephones to going on the air, and we want to be able to accommodate both our guests and also the people who call in as well. So I think I gave out the phone number earlier, and I think it can still be answered. Can I get a nod on that? Yeah, okay. So you could call and get stacked up for calling into the show and speaking with our two guests, Brandon B. of the Beehive Design Collective and Karen Francine, curator of the Art of Fire exhibition up in Fairbanks, right now at 1-800-478-8255, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, and the good old email is working, talk@alaskapublic.org. And what we've been going through is this idea of exposing artists over a period of time to research in the ongoing ecological research station in Bonanza Creek, which is part of the boreal forest, and which had a fire go through it. And so the fire went through the boreal forest, and clearly for an artist, the metaphor of fire is one that is very nice to get your hands on. So I would assume you have some vivid artwork that is up. Where is it being shown, Karen?
This month it's at the Bear Gallery at Alaska Land or Pioneer Park in Fairbanks, Alaska. And like I said, it'll be in Anchorage in January at Alaska Pacific University.
Right. And, you know, so while we were trying to reestablish our connection there, I was kind of explaining a little bit more of the process that is going through there at the long-term ecological research station. And that fire was a while ago now that went through there, right?
Yeah. As I understand, they've been studying fires as much as 30 years old.
Yeah,
they
have old fire scars there, yeah. But there was one that just went right down into it, and it wasn't too long ago, like 07, 08, someplace in there.
Yeah, and I know they were trying to set up some, like, on-site, you know, they were studying that as it was occurring, and so...
Yeah. So maybe you could kind of characterize what came out of it. In other words, what did the artists... choose to do, pick two or three, and give us some kind of notion of what they what they
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this in terms of what it is that the artists and the scientists get out of this process and what the outcome is as a result of that. And I'll use an example of one of the pieces. When the artist goes out into the field, and I'm speaking as a visual artist myself, most of what I'm collecting is visual sensory data, and that's what I'm engaged in. And I'm, you know, noticing nuances of color, play of light, form, texture, line, pattern, those, all those, you know, impressions that I can translate then into visual art. When I go out with a scientist, I'm also learning all this supplemental, very interesting details.
Keep going.
About what I'm looking at. And it really expands what I have to say about the subject. So I'll use an example of a piece that's in the show right now. We're all familiar with these scraggly little black spruce trees that get burned in these the interior and leave these skeletons of, you know, basically a thin, twisted twig of a stick with this big cluster of black charred cones at the top.
Right.
And so the scientists were explaining to us that, and I'm going to use a very interesting word, semi-serotonous. So
yeah.
These cones are semi-serotonous, which means that they require fire to release the seeds. And the implication of that is black spruce cannot reproduce by seeds unless they're burned. And so the fire is a very necessary process to the propagation of black spruce in the interior. And so it was really interesting because one of the gals did an encaustic piece, which is wax. And, you know, typically you might be interested by the shapes of these trees with these clumps of cones and, you know, paint a landscape picture of it. But she introduced these swirling seed shapes, you know, that just swirled through her picture. And she named the picture Funeral Pyre. And, you know, I thought initially, you know, they're kind of abstract, and I thought initially they were like, you know, little flames, but she explained to me, no, those are the semi-serotonous seeds being released by the fire. And so it turned it from just your conventional landscape to this amazing, you know, it incorporated this idea that most of us are unaware of. And I just think that that's the power of, for us as artists, to be learning some of these tidbits of information from scientists, because it gives you something a little bit new to say.
I think it can work the other way, too. You know, John Ruskin, long ago, was one of these artists that loved to get up into the mountains and look at them and contemplate their forms. And he came out with this observation about the curved form of mountains that later on informed the science of geology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, so it's actually, I think it goes back and forth. I think scientists also, they have a certain way that they're conceiving their experiments and deriving their data. And to get a different view of it sometimes can help them.
Well, and it's interesting you should bring that up, because I was reminded of a book I read a while back by an author called Leonard Schlain, S-C-H-L-A-I-N, I believe, and it's about art and physics. And throughout the book, he kind of weaves on his premise that many advances, you know, artistic movements preceded advances in physics. And it's been long enough ago since I read it that I couldn't probably spit out any specific examples. But for those people who are interested in the subject in general, that's an excellent read.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I think we finally have managed to get our connection reestablished with Brandon B. of the Beehive Design Collective. Brandon, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Steve. Glad I could be here.
Yeah. Thanks for bearing with us on the equipment.
Hey, no worries.
Basically, then the Beehive Design Collective is, I'm thinking of them as cartoonists, but you probably don't quite see it that way.
You know, not a lot of times people do associate us with cartoons, and we don't often mind the connection.
But it's they're big cartoons, maybe that's one way of putting it.
Yeah, so we do. We tend to draw a lot of plants and animals as our characters in our illustrations. They represent characters of both the ecology of a place, but also sort of issues of social justice and other political issues that we incorporate into the images. So they end up having some sort of human characteristics, but are typically drawn to some sort of scientific standard. So it's a fun in-between.
Yeah. And maybe you could go a little bit into your process, because and the thing has existed for how long now, Beehive Design Collective?
Yeah, so the Beehive Design Collective is an all-volunteer group of artists and activists who are generally based out of Maine, which is where I'm from. And the organization has existed for about 10 or 11 years now. It originally started as a stone mosaics collective, but sort of evolved into this group of folks who were drawing these illustrations and taking them out into the world to events and using them as sort of organizing tools, sort of education tools.
So, you get like, okay, your basic, somebody's politically motivated. They want to make a point. They want to communicate.
Sure.
They declare,
yeah.
You know, a rally or a public event of some sort. And
sure.
So, you know, out comes the creativity. And this always happens. Just the signs, whichever side or cause you want to take up, if people can get really creative about the kinds of signs that they wave to communicate with other people and to convey their identity and their message and so forth. You guys have gone way beyond this, though, in the sense of sort of a magnum opus of drawing.
Yeah, some of our illustrations can take 3 years to almost 8 years, which is one that's on the table right now. So there's definitely a lot of intention that goes into these projects, and it's for means of educating about what the issue is. So it's not just going to an event to say that we're upset about the way things are, but we want to sort of identify why that is and use the illustration as a means to talk about that. So it's like an entry point for folks to engage with the actual issue and the cause of what's going on.
And so far there have been two, and this is the third one. The first one had to do with globalization, world trade, and that sort of thing. And I think we're kind of finally figuring out where that one took us. I mean, I'm glad you're out there trying to get the message through. I wish it would have got through a little bit more than it did. Then you moved on to our subject of last week, I believe it was, which is the war on drugs. And,
sure.
And did a campaign on that, which I would assume would have to do, and I haven't actually looked at the poster and all that, but it would have to do with the colossal amount of money that gets wasted in the amount of people's rights that are being stomped on them for what?
Yeah. So the first, the graphics campaign sort of did start on the issue of globalization and free trade. So we made an image about free trade, and it was set to be a trilogy about globalization, the second of which was about the drug war in Colombia. And it was more or less using that as a lens to still talk about the way that globalization is affecting communities around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third graphic in that series is the one that's been on the table for upwards of 8 years now, and it's about resistance of mostly indigenous communities and people that live in the global south, so sort of highlighting the good parts of these stories and the resistance of those people. And then the one that you may have saw recently is a graphic that we started about coal extraction in Appalachia. And again, sort of using that as a lens to talk about something bigger and sort of connecting the dots to things like climate change and just global extraction in general.
All right, Brandon, Kirby joins the program from up in Palmer. Kirby, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. What do you say, Kirby?
I would just really encourage people to go see the Beehive Collective present their True Cost of Coal poster. You know, in South Central Alaska, we have four proposed coal mines, including some pretty massive strip mines similar to mountaintop removal sites in Appalachia. Three of these mines are directly adjacent to communities in the Mat-Su, Palmer, Sutton, and Chicloon. And there's an Australian company that just leased 10,000 acres of land in Chicxulub from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and they describe their coal lease as, quote, a beachhead for growth in Alaska. So I think this is a real serious issue for South Central Alaska. If you look at a map of coal reserves in Alaska, all of the communities in South Central Alaska, which is where most of the population of Alaska, or half the population of Alaska, lives, most of these communities are underlain by or near coal deposits. And it's real easy to imagine Alaska, or South Central Alaska, becoming the Appalachia of the North. And I think if you want to learn about what that could look like, the true cost of coal illustration is an incredible storytelling tool to tell the story of what's happened in Appalachia and educate ourselves about what could happen here.
All right, Kirby. Thanks for your call from Palmer. And Brandon, I guess that's kind of the intent, right?
It is. Yeah, it isn't exactly. So a lot of times we hear a lot of rhetoric about how extractive industries create jobs and how that serves the economy. But what we don't often hear about is really how these things affect people. So a lot of what our illustration is doing is taking the lens on how coal extraction has really affected communities in Appalachia, and how that's not an isolated issue. Certainly there's been a long history of coal extraction in that area, but extraction in general affects people in enormous, devastating ways. So we're bringing that story up to Alaska to highlight that role that these industries do have.
I'm fascinated that art is the vehicle, and that's kind of why I asked you to come in onto the program, because that's not what you usually think of art as doing.
Sure.
And, you know, Karin, as we have on here, this is probably fascinating to you, Karin, in that you've got also a process where artists are engaging in a different way.
Yes, and it's this is the first I'm delighting in hearing about this Beehive Design Collect, and hoping that I can get down and see some of the work. It really sounds wonderful, and just that ability to cultivate a wider audience and reach people about the issues is sorely needed.
Well, when you, Brandon, this process, you said you incorporate people's stories. How is that done?
Yeah. So for the True Cost of Coal graphic in particular, we started on a research trip of sorts, working with folks in organizations in the communities of Appalachia in the coal fields, and working foremost as outsiders coming into a struggle that was ongoing, and just doing a lot of on-the-ground networking and researching about what the issue is, and working with those folks in an ongoing way to develop the story, especially a story that would be useful to them in organizing their communities and teaching other folks about what's going on there. So
yeah, it's so like I have for instance, I picked up I went down to the old federal building where the giant True Cost of Coal poster, I guess we'll call it, was hanging in the form of a fabric. It had been printed out on the fabric, and it was essentially a very intricate narrative drawing, and largely in the fashion of cartoon's not quite the right word, but you know, zines, I guess. There's a huge amount of detail, and then you look wherever you look. Essentially, there's sort of a chain that will lead you to will follow the process, you know, until whatever it turns your stomach or you're shocked or outraged or your eyes just get tired.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we have this massive power plant and its emissions coming out, and then all these strange, menacing-looking tools kind of sticking out of it, as if it's a sort of a locomotive also, as well as being a power plant.
Yeah.
Now, clearly somebody is, I mean, this is reminding me of Marinetti 1909 and the Futurist Manifesto, where Marinetti told the poets that you need to start reflecting like the real world. Like we have speed now, for instance. You know, we move fast.
Uh-huh.
We have motors. Yeah. We have power. We have dynamos. Where's the art that has the power that's anywhere near this? We haven't really even answered that question today. But you guys are working with these type of metaphors. And I'm wondering how you get there. I mean, art by committee tends to be a little sterile. This is not sterile.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, it's definitely a lot of eraser marks on the page and a lot of moving pieces around and a lot of meetings together. But
I see. So by the time you get,
someplace stronger.
By the time you get to your final design, this massive, intricate pattern. Basically, everything has already been, I guess you would call it, storyboarded out. So you know how it's laid out.
Yeah.
And then how does the inking go, to get technical?
Sure. Yeah. So so sort of backtrack a little bit. There's a group of 9 of us that did this project. The illustrations probably didn't start for about 4 months, even into the research. And the storyboarding would have taken the greater part of 6 months to a year. And then finally, after a long period of time, the artists would sit down with pen and ink and take their sweet time because we want it to be carefully and intentionally done. So it takes a long time, and it's just a very long, careful process for them, especially in continuing to move pieces around. Even to this day, we can consider different parts of the poster that we might want to tweak a little bit, and we can go back in and do that.
So let me get it straight.
Project.
Is it an analog process, or does this all end up in some kind of digital storage medium? I mean, I picture it, inking and collaging, maybe the inked elements. And,
yeah, it's all hand drawn. It is all hand drawn, and there is one original copy on watercolor paper that's about 8 feet wide.
That's a big panel.
Yeah,
you know,
scanned it digitally, so it's. It's in there.
I see. So it's scanned, and that you could, so then you could manipulate it after it was scanned.
Right. We can manipulate contrast and small things. We don't go in to digitally draw things in, but we will hand draw things and maybe crop them in if we need to. That hasn't happened yet for this poster. But,
yeah. So is there some kind of big meeting where they say, okay, you have the meanest looking power plant that looks like a train and. It leads to a whole bunch of extractive machinery, what do they do? Do they vote? How do they decide? Okay, we're going to use this.
The collective operates a consensus model, so we do. We all are involved in the metaphor creation, and sometimes some more than others. And we will often sort of give some folks like. Sort of an authority on a certain piece, but we do generally all sort of contribute. Maybe an illustrator will draw something and then bring it to the group, and we'll all just sort of do a feedback session and do some more brainstorming. The brainstorming really never stops, so it's an infinite process, really.
Has everybody got day jobs? Does everybody have day jobs? Is that, I mean, do you have like a sort of a meeting point kind of situation? How do you work that?
Yeah, it's different for different bees. We are all volunteers, so there are some folks who have devoted their lives to the collective and work full-time. Folks like myself have been part-time with the collective. I've been part-time for about 4 years and was about full-time for a year before that for the beginning of the coal poster. But often we do have to support ourselves in other ways. But the collective, through our touring and education work, are able to make enough to make ends meet with the collective on a whole. So, I mean, that's a whole other part of the way that we operate is we do have a community project in Machias, Maine, where some folks live. But it's related but a little separate than our poster projects.
Wow. Well, it is, and I'm sure it's very hard to describe, but whatever it is it's managed to last this many years, so it's a presence that sits on this planet and continues to operate, and it was absolutely fascinating, and it's be interesting to have this presence in Alaska as the ongoing process happens with all this coal. So thanks for being with us, Brandon B., and please stick with us to the other side of the break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Fall semester is just around the corner. Alaska Pacific University offers two-year, four-year, master and doctorate level programs committed to student-centered experiential learning. And there's no application deadline. Online education options are available in all undergraduate programs. For more information on how to obtain a quality and affordable education, visit alaskapacific.edu or call 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
So after years in the Art Academy, at one point someone said to me, do you really want to spend the rest of your life making postage stamps for rich people's walls? And I was poleaxed by that statement. I was shocked. I said, you know, there's not a whole lot of point in that. I mean, maybe you reach the right rich person that can do something. Maybe it just sits in somebody's house. And they never even really experience whatever was put into the art. Maybe that's what happens to it. And so I've kind of been, ever since then, trying to think about art that does something more than creates postage stamps for rich people's walls. And it's a very, very interesting field to think about. Bob joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Thank you. I was born in between Fairbanks and North Pole in the year of 1959, and Ernest Green used to send out letters to parents back in those days saying what a great time of growth and prosperity it is in this state. And I was listening to you talk about art, and I have this little figurine that my mother made when she loved to do ceramics. It's a crying Eskimo. And, you know, I'm thinking my vision of Alaska, I don't think will ever come where we will ever have cheap energy in this state. I'm not a fan of coal by any means, but, you know, if I was an artist, I could see a drawing or a picture or a cartoon of a poor person standing there crying with empty pockets, standing next to a highway of vast resources that we can't touch, that we can't utilize. You know, the cost of living in the bush or even up in the North Pole area has gotten to the point where people can't afford to pay their electric bills or pay for stove oil and gasoline. You know, and it makes me sad. We sit on this great, great, vast resource, you know, natural gas, and it shouldn't be this way. You know, if I can envision an artist's drawing or conception of what I'm thinking, it would be a person standing there with empty pockets in the dark. I know that's a dark vision, but, you know, I've always thought that the people of Alaska should be able to utilize their resources in a way that was good for all, not to, as you say, freeze in the dark. You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to end this crisis? And I guess there's like 20 homes a week being put up for sale up in the North Pole area because people can't afford to pay their electric bills and pay for stove oil, heating fuel anymore. You know, and that really makes me sad. Anyway, that was my comment.
Bob, you drew a great picture in all of our minds with what you were saying with that, so I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I think that you know, it would be easy to start a fight at this moment. I, I don't really want to do it because I don't think it gets anywhere. But there is design is something to be looked at. You know, the design of the housing and the design. I mean, you know, if we actually are, and we are, turning out so much, burning so much right now, and the Chinese will be burning much more, that it's actually changed the climate, made our weather more violent, and is melting our permafrost. We got to start thinking more broadly about design, don't you think?
Yeah, well, there's a way that, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine up in Fairbanks the other day, and I said, too bad, you know, it was 85 degrees up there, and it was barely pushing 50 down here in Soldotna.
Yeah.
You know, and if, you know, too bad we couldn't store that energy, that heat in the ground and use it, then that's 50 below in the wintertime, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, the folks back in Maine, you know, you have a good cause and everything, but, you know, the darkness and the cold up here, it's always going to be dark and cold in Alaska in the wintertime. And we've got to figure out a way that we can take care of ourselves and be independent from big oil and coal. You know, coal is a dirty substance. You know, I've never lived in a house that's been heated by it. My aunt used to have coal in their little house on Well Street in Fairbanks.
We used to burn it in my house in Pennsylvania.
Well, Pennsylvania was a coal state,
and
I guess coal washes up on the beaches down here, you know, and people used to go out and use it in their little, in their coal furnaces and stoves and stuff back in the old days and stuff, but, you know, we've got to figure out a way to utilize this. People talk about small nuclear generators and things in some of the villages and places in the interior. You know, they wanted to build the Rampart Dam back when I was a little boy, which would have, on the Yukon River, which I believe at this point would have created electricity for the whole interior of the state, most likely.
Mm.
But it was never built because of costs, and I doubt if anything like that could ever be built now. But we have tidal power, and we have wind power. You know, we've got to put forward-thinking minds to work and solve this problem rather than being strangled by these oil companies who are supposed to be our friends who, you know, unless we give them billions of dollars back in taxes and whatever have you, I don't want to get involved in that either. But, you know, these people haven't turned out to be our friends, you know.
Yeah, Bob, and sometimes the government says it's here to help you and they're not.
yeah, you know, and I think Alaska, I had an old friend named Joe Vogler many, many years ago. He's passed away now, but, you know, the stranglehold that the federal government has put on this state and not giving us land and the opportunity to actually take care of ourselves, you know, and they're going against why they let us become a state, why they signed us on to become part of the United States. Mm-hmm. They're strangling us in this way.
All right, Bob.
So we can be stewards of our own country. Thank you.
All right, yeah, thank you very much. Brendan, I'm going to toss that one back to you. I'm sure you've heard this sort of thing before at the Beehive Design Collective. When you talk about the true cost of coal, you're not,
mm-hmm.
it's not like people, you want to wipe people out of the equation, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question, right? It's so many people are affected in different ways, and we start to talk about energy, and it's, and there are a lot of solutions to that in small ways, and there's no one thing that I could say that would be a clear answer, but that's sort of what our poster does in a lot of senses, is there are a lot of people coming up with smaller scale solutions, and a lot of times it is about scale, and that's something I've noticed in my experience anyways. It seems like a lot of folks can create their own solutions in smaller ways that are more sustainable and more viable for their communities than a larger outside corporation could, while keeping their best interests.
Well, and as a matter of fact, what is popping into my head there, Brandon, is the the last project that the Beehive Design uh-huh. Collective had, where they started out attacking yeah. the war on drugs and ended up talking about how people in South America can be self-sufficient.
Right, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you don't get one without the other. And I think when you think your way through one, you get to the other. But it's like we have problems sometimes with having that type of insight and that type of persistence to really bore in. And I think to go back to the Art of Fire in Bonanza Creek and Karin Francine, that's kind of what you guys found, is that your process, the process that was gone through for the artists and for the scientists, needed time to mature. Like you were talking about the next one, which is, I think, is Trophic Cascade, the next event or exhibit. It's already well into the cooking up.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting speaking with this group of artists, too. We're realizing that even the two-year time frame it's only a starting point. Because for Trophic Cascades, we met at Denali National Park, and it was hosted by the Muri Science and Learning Center. Our funding, again, was from LTER. But Trophic Cascades, oversimplified, is basically a predator-prey relationships. And we were able to speak to the park superintendent about management issues. And in the context of radical, dramatic climate change and what that's going to mean for species that don't have time to adapt or migrate, or and how that's going to affect their management policies. And then we were also out in the field with wolf biologist Tom Meyer and ornithologist Carol McIntyre. Again, just learning about how the system works in the present day, but then considering, you know, what some of the changes to climate and how they're going to impact all of the dynamics of the park. And in meeting together with the artists who are involved in this, you know, we're looking at putting together a show for a year from now, but we all realize that for all of us, you know, a year is still a very small amount of time to process that. I think at best we'll be able to have a first draft by a year from now, and we all sense that this is going to be something that will have long-term implications for our individual focuses in our own individual art, bodies of art.
Yeah, you know, I understand you're going to have the fertile mind of Jack Dalton involved in this, and I can't even imagine what Jack is likely to come up with, given a whole year to think about it.
Oh, I tell you, we were sitting around the campfire one evening, and that guy has a fertile mind. Already is coming up with some good ideas.
He's very used to a short deadline.
Yes.
Well, it is. Just to throw in a little bit more about the climate warming and predator and prey and so forth. At the AAAS this past year at Vancouver, there was a set of talks about the invasive species, and do we really understand what ecology is? And it was very interesting that, you know, we think of different things as having ecological niches, but the fact of the matter is we don't really know how big the niche is, how much of that niche is occupied. And we don't really know where the genetic, when you get down to the genetics, where are the genetic adaptive capacities of anything? And we're going through this right now with polar bears, where we discover now that genetically polar bears and grizzly bears have crossed several times down through the past. That doesn't mean that grizzly bears and polar bears will cross again, but they have in the past. It's just like, they need new ways of thinking about these things. The scientists themselves do. They have all these great tools now. I mean, just the genetic analysis or the isotope analysis, to pick two of them, tell them way more information than they can handle. To get their heads around it conceptually is getting to be very difficult and a creative endeavor indeed.
Well, and you know, something that you made me think of too, you know, the Earth has faced massive extinction. You know, we think commonly of the age of the dinosaurs, and from what we understand. There are cataclysmic events that caused massive extinctions during that period, and maybe we're the next cataclysm. You know, with what we've set in motion with the rapid warming of the climate and acidification of the oceans and what have you. I mean, it is a real serious issue. And for as much as I share, you know, the concern for people's individual losses and needs, you know, on a microeconomic scale, we can't ignore what's happening, you know, on a global scale and the impact it's going to have on all of us.
Yeah, it's a it's being called the Anthropocene, and it's actually scientists are using that term now, and it has to do with the fact that the pace of change is so fast compared to what happens in any other type of geologic time scales. I mean, your basic Milankovic is 20,000,
mm-hmm.
and so you've got that's a TikTok that goes 20,000. But here we're dealing with something that's just in the hundreds,
right?
I mean, in the small hundreds and less than hundreds, decadal even, and this stuff is changing really fast. The acidification of the ocean alone is probably already having consequences that nobody has any idea of. We could be seeing that in what's happening to our Chinook salmon this very moment.
Well, and you know, and it's not to say that all changes are going to be bad.
No.
You know, certainly there's areas that are not suitable for agriculture now that will be. But as time goes on, and this is what's so interesting about meeting with the scientists, is the research is ongoing. And as the time goes on, they get a better and better set of data to work with that is more predictive and more accurate because of the accumulation of time. And so for all the unknowns, you know, some of the certainties are starting to emerge out of all of the unknown.
Indeed. And it works different than journalism because when you wipe out the paradigm, it's actually gone.
Right.
It didn't come back like it does in journalism to haunt us yet more. Let's go. Wait a minute. We better do a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with MyPFD info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The subject on Talk of Alaska is Art with Engagement, and we've got Karen Francine, the curator of the Art of Fire exhibition in Fairbanks and coming to Anchorage, and Brandon B. of the Beehive Design Collective, and Sean joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sean.
Yes, I got a question for Brendan, and it might end up being a follow-up as well. When you did your Appalachian project, how long were you actually immersed in the culture of Appalachia? Because I'm from there, and I've got a few things to say about people who've done projects down there.
Sure. I definitely already welcome your comment. I think it's a really important topic and something that we took really, we were really sensitive about because we know of the history of outsiders coming in to do projects of Appalachia like they're some sort of specimen in a petri dish, right? So that was definitely a thought of ours, and we were really careful, and we worked with folks immediately from the coal field in organizations that were welcoming us as a project that would serve their needs and not the other way around. So we continue to work with folks in Appalachia in a very ongoing, intimate way as the project evolves. But there will always be room for criticism of the way that we work. We know that we're not perfect all the time. But we do our best to really be sensitive to being outsiders in that area, for sure.
But you didn't answer the question. How long have you been immersed in Appalachia in this project? Give me a duration.
We've been immersed since 2007 when the project started.
Okay, so is primarily your focus mountaintop removal type issues, or are you looking beyond that in terms of the past socioeconomic impact over the last 30 years where there's been an out-migration of young people mm-hmm. out of Appalachia? And unlike Alaska, here in Alaska, we actually support ghost towns and keep them going. That isn't done in Appalachia. They're allowed to wither and die.
Right, right. Yeah, our graphic definitely is sort of a sweeping history from even the colonization of the area and looking through the past 30 to 50 years, and definitely a large part in even a specific scene of our graphic is discussing that out-migration of youth as they try to decide whether they're going to work in the coal fields at a Walmart or at a prison, or if they're going to go away to college someplace else and run away from, like, the ghost towns that you mentioned.
Yeah,
sure.
There's been, you know, we've seen, I'm from the area, so I've seen the out-migration, and there's just going to be nothing but ghost towns littered through Appalachia. You know, like I said, here in Alaska, we have a policy of, keeping ghost towns alive, a de facto policy, but none such exists. I'd like to thank you guys for your work in the area, and I hope you guys keep up good work, and we actually see some fruitful results from some of your work down there. We haven't in the past from others, but I remain hopeful.
Hey, thanks so much.
All right, Sean from Fairbanks. Thanks a lot for that call. I really enjoyed that. Let's go to Allie, joins the program from Chickaloon. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Allie.
Hey, Steve, how's it going?
Great.
Brandon, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show and for bringing the Beehive up to Alaska. And I think a vision that you're trying to create is something that we've tried to grasp and get our hands on and our heads around for a long time. And Alaska is a really different place in terms of people's perspectives of the land and resources. And we really have a lot to learn from what's happened in other places like Appalachia. And, you know, specifically I'm talking about the potential for, you know, three big coal mines in the Matanuska Valley. You know, we're battling a 10,000 acre coal mine in Chickaloon right now with an Australian company wanting to extract resources and send them, of course, to China or Japan.
You know, Allie, that's kind of a weird one because it goes through the trust. They call it the trust. But
it's
mental health lands, and it's this odd thing where it's not quite state land, it's not quite federal land, it's mental health land, and its whole purpose and the whole mission of the Mental Health Trust is to make money off of whatever land holdings they get dribbed and drabbed onto them by the legislature or whatnot. So they're kind of trapped into, as you know, a mission of trying to make money off of that land. Every once in a while, it gets so politically controversial that they trade it off to the feds or somebody. But in exchange for something else that they can try and make money off of. But in this case, you know, you've got yourself 10,000 acres. You've got 10,000 acres, and I take it it's near you. And,
it's surrounding our community. They'll say it's near us, but it's actually almost a circle around our entire community.
And it's 10,000 acres, and it's already been leased, yeah?
Yes, it's been leased. There are a few holdups right now, but pretty much you know, this company, Riversdale, is used to going into Mozambique and all around the world, and we're connected with Rio Tinto at one point in time, who you know is affiliated with Pebble Mine, and they are used to just relocating communities, buying out neighbors. It's a pretty dirty game. The rest of Alaska doesn't really know about it. And I think that, you know, as we talk to these artists and Brandon and your other guests, you know, I'm just visualizing in my head. I see the power of art in being able to help push this message and this future of, you know, here we are as Alaskans, let's choose what we want to do with this land around us. Let's change this paradigm that's been forced upon us in Alaska as resource-driven. We need to extract everything just for the sake of it and for the sake of jobs and the sake of, you know, what we're being told is, you know, healthy families and healthy communities, which is the complete opposite. We need to change that paradigm and that mind shift. And personally, I think it'd be awesome to have more artwork all over the city and in different towns, like the Beehive is doing, to invoke that that thought, so that we can start thinking differently and not be so fear-based. We need those creative ideas and those cooperative efforts and the out-of-box thinking to solve these destructive issues that are planned to destroy our communities. And let me just say one last thing about, you know, all the food in this state, right, that the 2 to 5% that's grown here, which is nothing, everything else is brought in from outside, that all comes from the valley. Everything is downwind, downriver from these potential coal mines. So some food for thought. And again, thanks for being on the show and sharing your ideas. And we'll welcome you guys as you travel through our communities.
All right, Brandon.
Thanks, Sally.
And I think we'll send it back to Karin, who we started with, and the Art of Fire Project and the Trophic Cascade and so forth. Words that were interesting to me from Allie's mouth were power of art. Who knew?
Yes. And I think, you know, getting people aware of issues in a non-threatening way and allowing them to think about what they can do, what the impact is at their local level, and what can be done at their local level. I mean, because that's really where most positive change starts from.
Yeah.
And it needs to get out there, you know, and, you know, the message needs to be everywhere, you know, just to raise the awareness.
And then, something else. But, you know, there's something, there's between how the artist figures out how to make the artwork and what the artwork accomplishes out in the world, well, there's still a really huge, huge gap.
Right.
Yeah. There's just a whole world in there. And as we get, as you get closer to this gap, the gap gets bigger. And I think probably all of us need to figure out how do we throw our own particular piece in there. This might be different. Certainly a piece that nobody else has.
Well, everybody has specialized knowledge, and I like what the guy was talking about earlier, you know, just for example, building more energy-efficient houses, driving a more energy-efficient car. I mean, there's all things every single one of us can do, and, you know, communicating this idea of this massive change that's occurring, you know, is a first step, but then everybody has to take the next step
all right.
on their own.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Brandon. I look forward to meeting you.
Sounds good, Steve.
All right. Thanks to Josh Edge and Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik, provimaging.com. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.